So welcome to the second talk on the heart of the matter. So the second talk on for six talks happening in the city on Jesus' revolutionary words. And the topic we're considering today is the core problem of the heart. Now just to give you a little bit of background, what we're doing is just really, I'm going to speak for about 20 minutes or so on Jesus' words, which are printed on the outline, which hopefully you got when you came in. And I'm going to do my best to communicate what I think Jesus is saying. Now, you might not believe in God. You might not even believe in Jesus. You might not believe he existed. I'm going to work from the point, at least in the talk, presuming that God exists and that Jesus said these things, not necessarily recognizing that you do. So there's an opportunity to ask questions, make comments afterwards, challenge me on something I've said. But because I'm trying to faithfully represent Jesus' words, he believed there was a God, so we'll go from that basis. Okay, well, we'll get started. You follow along in your outline. There's a few headings there, and there's a bit more information that we'll talk about in the end. Well, imagine for a moment that you suddenly discovered, it happened to you when you were on the train, that just by looking at someone, you could suddenly see inside their heart. You could see their deepest desires. You could see their roiling emotions, maybe, if something was going on. You could see their hopes and their dreams. Well, that made the train ride interesting. But, you know, you'll probably never see most of those people again, so you can cope with what you saw. But you're just about to walk into your section on the office floor, and there's a new person there, an employee, and as you look at them, don't ask me how this works, it's your imagination, right? But as you look at them, you can see deep into their heart. And what you see is maybe rage at their new boss because of an offhand remark. Maybe lust after a woman who works in the office as well. The secretary has just walked in. Or maybe it's envy of the corner office that somebody has. I know it's all open plan offices now, isn't it? When it's corner offices. Someone's got a higher wall around their open plan office and has some privacy. How would you relate to that person? Do you think it would be hard if you could see those inner thoughts? Now, if we go with the great Australian ethic is, you can do whatever you like, as long as it doesn't hurt someone. Would you? You'd say that was the great Australian ethic. Is that a reasonable guess of the great Australian ethic? You can do whatever you like, as long as it doesn't hurt someone. You've just met this person. You've seen inside their heart. And they haven't hurt anyone. And yet, we'd still find it hard to relate to them. We'd still find it hard to kind of, we'd be worried about either their rage, or maybe their lust, or maybe their envy. And yet, the great Australian ethic is, it doesn't matter what someone does as long as they don't hurt someone. And yet, instinctively, we actually know that there's more to things going on than just our actions, just the consequences of our actions. And that's actually what we're going to explore today, I guess. We're going to explore Jesus' words on maybe the connection between what we do and what's going on in our hearts. What we do and what's going on in our hearts. But before I go a bit further, let me just make a comment. You might not be Christian. That's wonderful. The City Bible Forum actually isn't really for Christians. The City Bible Forum is for anyone who's interested in thinking about the bigger questions in life. So don't feel like you're out of place if you're not Christian. The City Bible Forum is basically trying to create opportunities for people to think about the bigger questions in life. That's our starting premise, not that you're Christian. So why would it matter? Why would it matter about what's going on in the heart? Well, it matters for relationships. We can already see that. So let me leap right in. And I realised I've not picked up my own outline, so I can't read the passage. So if you just open the outline, we'll be looking at that second paragraph. We'll come back to the first one. We're going to look at the second paragraph. It's under the title, "So I Got a Little Angry." So I got a little angry. So I got a little angry. Jesus says this at the very... He's teaching in a famous Sermon on the Mount. He's gone up to a large crowd has gathered around him. And he started to teach them. And we've already had the start of, from chapter 5 of Matthew's biography in the first talk. We talked about the famous Beatitudes. Now, blessed are the, you know, one of them you might have heard of, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. It's an example of those. You've also probably seen that taken off on Monty Python. Blessed are the cheesemakers. You know, that's reference to Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. But Jesus continues on. And we're going to pick it up at sentence 21, in that middle paragraph. Jesus says this: "You've heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment." Isn't that a slightly shocking statement? Isn't that a slightly shocking statement? Anyone who's angry will actually be subject, it sounds like, because he uses the same word, to the same judgment as someone who murders. Or at least the same severe assessment. Jesus is picking up on his words when he says, "You've heard it said to the people long ago, do not murder." That was the sixth commandment in the Old Testament. And Jesus kind of takes that, but drives it further. Sentence 22, "But I tell you," he's actually equating anger and murder. He's making them equivalent. Does that seem strange to you? I think it should feel a little bit strange. But the funny thing is, our law actually makes the same equation. I know that sounds really strange, but our law makes the same equation. The difference between murder and manslaughter, the charge of murder and manslaughter, is not whether or not you murdered someone. The difference is your intention. If you intended to kill someone, even if you failed, you could be charged with murder. If someone died by your actions and you didn't intend, it's manslaughter. So our law actually recognises that actually the consequence, so you could kill someone, the consequence is irrelevant. Oh, sorry, not for them. But, you know, you could kill someone and the consequence actually matters, but when the charge comes to you, how it matters to you, the difference is whether or not you intended for them to die or not. So whether you'll be charged with murder or not. But let me take this nexus between anger and murder further. See, when does murder happen? When does murder happen in our society? This is a chart, it's a little bit small, but these are the charts for female victims of murder. And just have a look how often it's a horror story murder. You know, that some random person does something mean at a popcorn party in the middle of the night and murders everyone there. See, it's only 6% of the time is any murder of a woman in Australia by a stranger. What's the largest time, the largest connection for when a woman is murdered? Who murders her? The intimates. De factos, partners. See? And family is another category. Mothers, fathers, father-in-laws, and then friends and acquaintances. Isn't that amazing? Now, why? I'm presuming it's because of anger, deep-seated anger that's in the relationship. I'm sure, you know, hopefully it wasn't whimsical. It wasn't a whimsical murder. And that wouldn't make sense if its intimates are doing the murdering. Same for blokes. A little bit different. Blokes, their wives, girlfriends are less likely to murder them, only 10%. The fairer sex is indeed fairer. Isn't that great? It's good to know. 25% of the time, 1 in 4, you could be murdered by a stranger. That's probably because blokes hang out at strange places. But, see, 36% of murders happen because of a friend or an acquaintance, and 15% because of family. Well, your family are more dangerous than your wife or girlfriend or partner, so you should go for less dinners at your mother's. Statistics. Got to be careful with statistics. But can you see the nexus? Why is it that those stats are true? It's because it's anger in the relationship that leads to murder. But what's further on? Whoops. See, Jesus actually digs away a bit further for us. Look at sentence 22. Jesus says this. These are quite shocking words. Second half. "But I tell you that anyone who's angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, raka, which is kind of like imbecile, but probably with a swear word in front of it, is answerable to Sanhedrin, which is the Jewish court. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. He's actually not contrasting them. He says, anyone who says to his brother, you dot, 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 imbecile, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. And anyone who says, you fool, is in danger of the fire of hell. Basically, you two will fall under judgment. You two will be judged for what you say and how you treated someone else. See, Jesus is picking up on, at the heart of this murder and anger, is disregard for others. And I think you hear it all the time when you hear someone, usually a bloke, say about someone else, well, he's a dot, 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 idiot. Don't you hear that? It's that casual disregard for other people, for their existence, for their rights. Survey of 3,600 women in 1996 showed that 42% of women who'd been in a previous relationship had suffered physical abuse. So almost one in two women had suffered physical abuse in a previous relationship. And that's just physical abuse. Didn't include emotional, financial, or social abuse. See, that's the same thing, isn't it? It's that disregard for another person. We saw it, didn't, I don't know if you heard it, but the tape recording of Mel Gibson about the things he said about his now ex-partner. That disregard for another person. But this is the interesting thing. I think Jesus is picking up on the story of Cain and Abel way back in Genesis chapter 4, but we don't have time to go there. But look at sentences 23. Jesus then makes another move. Sentence 23, therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to your brother. Then come and offer your gift. It's a very interesting statement. See, he's actually saying disregard for others is offensive to God. You think you can do something religious. You can go to an altar. That's what he has in mind. You think you can go to an altar and offer something to God and get in good with God, that you can honour God. But your brother, as someone in the Jewish nation, you've done something to offend them. They've got something against you. He's saying, your gift is not acceptable to me until you get your relationship sorted out with that other person. Which is interesting, isn't it? I think one of the implications is of that double standard. You know, there's lots of conversation in our society at the moment about religion being used to justify evil, a la pedophilia. Well, this says that God won't accept the religiosity of those religious people because they've wronged their brother or sister or child. See, yeah, it's an interesting connection, isn't it? God himself says, don't try and honour me. Unless, of course, you know, if you've dishonoured somebody else, get those things sorted out before you try and honour me. See, it matters even to God. We're going to move on to another category, and you might be feeling a bit shocked by that, but Jesus actually has six of these topics he deals with. He's going to deal with two of them. And the next one is just a harmless perv. Just a harmless perv. Now, I don't know if you've ever been in a conversation with someone, you're talking to them, and you've got good eye contact with them, and then their eyes, it's mainly for the blokes, their eyes drift away in a horizontal line over your right shoulder. Why is that? If you're a guy, you know. Because Jessica Rabbit has just Jessica Rabbit has just walked by on your left or right. In fact, it doesn't have to be Jessica Rabbit. A lady of any form or description will do. Jesus says this. Let's remove Jessica. She's a little too buxom, isn't she? Jesus says this. Sentence 27. You've heard that it was said, do not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Now, I think once again we'd want to say, how can you equate lust and adultery? Surely they're different. Aren't the consequences different? So if I committed adultery and my partner, my wife, Catherine, found out about it, sure as eggs, we would be divorced. Sure as eggs. But if she saw me, it's a terrible phrase, but I'm using it because it's how we think. If she saw me having just a harmless little perv, it probably wouldn't lead to divorce. Maybe. But see, yes, if you look at the consequences, you might want to say they're different. But if you look at the heart, they're the same. A newspaper article in 2006 was looking about this. They said, showed that 50% of people dabbling, 50% of people dabbling in online romances, I'm not quite sure how you dabble in a romance, but anyway, that aside, right? 50% of people who are dabbling in an online romance were already in a relationship. So, you know, you log on to an internet dating site and it says there's 1,000 people logged on. That means 500 of them are already in a relationship. So why are they dabbling? Or another study, and this was a study of cyber cheaters. So people who admitted that they were engaging in that kind of online double dating romance thing. They're all such new categories for me. I've got the right language to define them. So this survey was of 200 cyber cheaters. It found that out of the 200, over 100 were actually having multiple online affairs. 30 out of the 200 had met. So these are cyber cheaters. So this is a category of people who admitted that they were double timing, that they were being unfaithful to a partner, girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever. 30 of those had met for sex out of the 200. So 1 in 6. Is that right? No. Yeah, 1 in 6. Or, you know, 1 in 6 point, whatever. 60 of them had just met with someone that they'd met online, that they'd arranged to have a coffee or lunch or dinner. And most, and this is just a quote, most, however, had just, this is a quote from the survey, restricted themselves to cyber sex. I don't even want to kind of go there. See, what is the cause of the multiple relationships? It's lust. It's lust that leads to adultery. Jesus is equating them because if you have lust, it's that unfaithfulness in your heart that actually leads to adultery. It's the same unfaithfulness, though. Aren't they that far removed from each other? This article talked about one woman discovered that her husband was spending a lot of time on the internet, and on the internet, at the same time, he was wooing two women at the same time. What did she do about it? What do you think? She divorced him. How could she do that? He hadn't hurt anyone yet. Right? You can do whatever you like as long as you don't hurt anyone. He hadn't. He was just wooing them. I mean, he hadn't actually slept with them. He hadn't committed. Or had he? She thought so, didn't she? Because she was the person in the relationship affected. She divorced him. And there was an article just at the start of this year about online websites that are actually for unfaithful partners. So they're actually there for you to find someone just for a one-night stand. And even more specifically, if you are actually looking for a fling and you're already in a relationship, they're actually out there. See, they're appealing to the lustful heart. See, I think we can separate lust and adultery in our mind in the Western culture if you view sex as something separate from relationship. But if you view this in the context of a relationship, then suddenly lust and adultery suddenly make sense, don't they? Like, that's why a woman who discovers that her husband is wooing two other women sees it as adultery, because he's denied that his relationship with her. He's acted on his lust. Now, let me just make one small caveat. Jesus actually is not condemning, because if you're sitting there thinking, you're thinking, well, hang on, how can I, you mean every time I notice someone beautiful, that's it, I'm condemned for adultery? The NIV, which is the translation of the Bible here, is actually a little unhelpful. The text actually says, in the original language, but I tell you, anyone who looks at a woman, or who It's the reason they translate it badly is because of the it's clunky. But I tell you that anyone who looks in order to look at a woman lustfully has committed adultery with her in his heart. So the difference is, it's a purpose clause. Anyone who with purpose looks lustfully is what it says. So the difference might be, you're walking down Queen Street Mall, and we'll put the shoe on the other foot, you're a woman and you see a good looking guy in a nice suit, and you think, oh, that's a good looking guy. God has made a wonderful piece of creation. I don't think that's lust. It's when you have the second look. It's when the look lingers. It's when you look to look a bit more. That's when it's turned from noticing part of God's good creation and his kindness of making people beautiful and appealing to you wanting some of that. What's at stake here? You know, what's at stake here? I just had a harmless little perv. What does Jesus think is at stake? Well, this is a bit shocking. Sentence 29. These are Jesus' words. I understand them and I'm confident in them. Oops. I missed it. What's at stake here? Sentence 29. If your right eye causes you to sin, because Jesus is just following on from the section about lustful looks. If your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. It's dramatic. And it actually is rhetorical. It's a rhetorical device that Jesus is using. He didn't actually want people to gouge out their right eye. There's a few reasons we know that. The structure of the language, it's a kind of a rhetorical way of structuring things. None of his disciples, who were his closest followers, gouged out their right eye or cut off their hands. But also, more importantly, in other parts of, and this is the problem with reading isolated bits of the Bible, in other parts of Matthew's biography about Jesus, Jesus makes it very clear that it's the centre of our personality, our heart, where sin resides. And so you'd have to, in the words of that terrible Robin Hood movie, you have to scoop your heart out with a spoon in order to get rid of the problem, and then you'd be dead. So that really wouldn't, sort the problem out. And if you get, scoop out your right eye, what about your left eye? What about all the things you've already seen? No, he's being rhetorical, but his point still stands. The reason he's so dramatic is because what's repeated in sentence 29 and sentence 30. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. He's using such strong language. Now, if Jesus is just a good teacher, he's really crossed the line here, hasn't it? Modern teaching methods, you don't scare your students, frighten them into learning that 1 plus 1 equals 2. Jesus, what's he doing frightening people like that? Well, actually, unless of course he believes that hell is true, in which case he's not frightening them, is he? He's warning them. And if you thought something like facing God in judgment was true, then strong language would be appropriate. That's just Jesus' assumption there. See, these fierce rules, right? Once again, if you think about them in context of relationship, you think, well, Jesus is just down on us having a little fun. But the interesting thing is, if you think about it in the context of relationship, it's actually because the woman, let's just say a man is wooing two other women in a relationship, it's actually because Jesus cares so much about the women being wooed that judgment comes. That they are not made to be treated like that. That man should not have that disregard for them such that he could woo them while he's already committed to someone else. And that man should have not such disregard for his wife or partner that he would so dishonour her. So when you put those things in the context of relationship, it's actually, you start to see that Jesus cares. Same with the strong language. It's actually because that ... idiot is someone that Jesus has created and cares about and loves. So when you disregard them, you disregard God. Well, what's the way forward here? The start of the section what we miss, Jesus says this. Jesus fulfills the law of God. Jesus says this. Do not think that I've come to abolish the law of the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. Jesus thinks that the Old Testament laws, such as do not murder, don't commit adultery, honor your parents, honor God, really matter. But actually, see, he says, I have not come to abolish them. And he could say, but to help you obey them, or so that you keep them. But he actually says, to fulfill them. Jesus sees himself as the way in which all these commands actually find their fulfillment. And he's speaking to his disciples. And it's as his disciples come to him first that then fulfillment flows out of that. Jesus actually doesn't think that we can make our way to God by keeping these rules or these standards, or that we'd be able to keep them by ourselves. Now, he does expect them to be kept. Look at sentence 20. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. So he says, the religious people have these rules and caveats. Your righteousness, if you're going to be one of my followers, has to be greater than theirs for you to get into heaven. And then what he does in that next thing that I've talked about, we just talked about some of that, he looks back at the heart of what's at the heart of God's word in the Old Testament and strips away all the kind of barnacles that people had put on them in order to keep them. Because if you don't look at the standard, see, if you don't actually look at the standard that, just imagine, you might not believe there's a creator God, but just imagine there is a creator God who made you. If we don't look at his standard, we'll never see that there's a problem. You know, if we have rules and conditions, you know, there's nothing wrong with just a harmful perv. Well, you know, it was just cyber sex. Then, if we keep doing that, then we can kind of think that we somehow meet the Creator God's standard that he made us for. But Jesus doesn't want us to be deluded. So he strips away all our excuses. So we can starkly hear what our Creator expects of us. And what, if we were to be one of Jesus' followers, if you were, what he actually would expect. But I don't think, I'm not going to talk about how that he sorts that problem out for us, because there's more talks to come. But let me leave it there. That's kind of a petering out ending, but let me open it for questions and comments, and maybe then I can clarify what's not clear.